It is closing in on 40 years this fall since the Camp David Accords were signed. 12 days of secret negotiations at Camp David trying to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, fast forward to the conflict today and the recent U.S. decisions to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. How are these decisions influencing the peace process? We are taking apart that question this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Veteran diplomat Charlie Reese is Vice President International at the RAND Corporation. His research focuses on the economics of international development. He spent three decades in the State Department, previously served as an ambassador and U.S. Foreign Service officer in both the Middle East and Europe, including coordinator for economic transition in Iraq at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. Ambassador Reese, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Kate. Delighted to be with you.
Well, let's start by talking about the most recent development in the U.S. stance toward Israel. In an interview with a conservative Israeli news outlet over the weekend, President Trump said he thinks that Israel and Palestine aren't interested in brokering a peace deal right now and said, quote, "I don't know, frankly, if we're going to even have talks." The president also said that Israel should, quote, be careful with its construction of settlements on Palestinian territories. So what do you make of all of these comments, especially after the White House has shown itself to be explicitly pro-Israel?
Well, I think every American administration, going all the way back to President Carter, as you mentioned, the Camp David Accords, has always wanted, at some level, Arab-Israeli or Palestinian-Israeli peace accord, so as to remove this particular issue from the agenda, and particularly reduce the incentive for radicalization that comes with the unresolved status of these territories and the relationship between Israel and its Arab neighbors. So the president, though, is reflecting pessimism that either side is particularly prepared to step up and make compromises to the other side to have an enduring two-state solution or any other kind of solution. And indeed, you know, Secretary Kerry made a huge effort during the Obama administration that kind of blew up in 2015 when both sides walked away from the table. And there hasn't been an active peace process since then. President Trump, after his inauguration, set up a new special envoy, and his son-in-law Jared Kushner has taken a special interest in trying to put back a vision that would be something that the two sides could compromise on, but hasn't had a lot of success with that effort, or at least a visible success. They've suggested privately that they have suggested to the public that privately they're making progress. It's not been evident. So it is not particularly happy times for the Middle East peace process or optimistic times, and that is the environment in which the Jerusalem embassy move decision was announced in December.
Yeah, Ambassador, you have spent decades living and breathing embassies. How does moving the embassy to Jerusalem impact these negotiations?
Well, first of all, let me talk about the sort of practical aspects. The United States has, of course, long had diplomatic relations, full diplomatic relations with the State of Israel. Our embassy is located down by the beach in Tel Aviv, where it's always been. But that hasn't stopped the ambassador, the counselors and attachés and whatever from calling on Israeli government officials in Jerusalem. West Jerusalem is where the prime minister's office is. Many, if not all, of the government ministries and the parliament and so forth. So people are able to do the job. They just have to go to West Jerusalem to call on on these officials in their offices, which is the sort of typical thing that you do when you're in an embassy. You go to officials in their offices, or meet them socially in restaurants, mm-hmm. or something like that. So, as a practical matter, this hasn't constrained that. I would say also, as a practical matter, we have long had a conflict in Jerusalem. The American Consulate General Jerusalem is a office building with classified telecommunications and so forth, and a staff that provides consular services to American citizens and does visas and so forth. And it also is a place from which the United States has interactions with the Palestinian Authority. Palestinian Authority is the it came out of the Oslo Accords and is the administrative body for the areas under Oslo that the Palestinians administer. And it's based in Ramallah, which is about 15, 20 miles away from Jerusalem. So
what I'm hearing from a practical day-to-day sense that all of these inner working parts of what make up an embassy, they can carry on regardless of really where you're based. But what about right. the optics?
Right. Well, that's the important part of this decision. And I might add, when the president made his decision, he also signed a waiver that every president since Clinton, at least, has signed a waiver to say we're not going to move the embassy for the next 6 months. This relates to a piece of legislation. So, but the importance of this decision is that the final status of Jerusalem has been an issue for the peace process. It was one of those important issues that would be resolved along with territory and settlements and the right of return and all these other issues that have to be put together in a package. And by the American embassy decision implies that the Americans don't feel that that should be on the table. In fact, the president has said that I've taken it off the table. Well, if you take an issue off the table, you make it harder to put together an agreement. Now, as I started out by saying, there haven't been any active talks, and it didn't look like it was going well before that. But this is interpreted both in the Middle East itself and in Europe and among other allied countries as making it harder to reach an agreement, which all agree would be, or all accept would be, a good thing. And it does so because by announcing that the American embassy is going to move to Jerusalem, and doesn't say, we don't say West Jerusalem or East Jerusalem, we just say Jerusalem, the implication is that the United States recognizes or accepts Israel's sovereignty over all of the city. And that's the issue that has been suggested ever since the peace process has started. Mm-hmm. That's been one of the issues to be resolved.
Ambassador Charlie Reese is with us. He's a vice president at the RAND Corporation, where his research focuses on the economics of international development. He spent a better part of three decades as a career foreign service officer for the State Department, which included serving as coordinator for economic transition in Iraq at the U.S. Embassy there in Baghdad. You can join this conversation about the peace process and the conflict in the Middle East at 800-642-1234. Have you traveled there? Do you have family or friends living there? What are your questions for the ambassador about the evolution of the Mideast peace process? Can peace be achieved? What do you think of the Trump administration's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel? Join in to the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ambassador Reese, how has all of this and the decision to withhold $65 million from a UN agency that aids Palestinian refugees, how has it affected peace negotiations that are underway between the Israelis and the Palestinians? We also learned this week that it looks like the Palestinians want a different go-between negotiator than the U.S. with talks with Russia.
That's right. Well, yes, the Palestinians have in the aftermath of the president's decision in December, announced that they would not accept the United States as a neutral arbiter or a honest broker in in the peace process. And they have President Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, who is the president of the Palestinian Authority, has made a lot of travels. He's been to Cairo, he's been to Jordan and Brussels in December, and he is now in Moscow. He is looking for another international broker that would help bring the Israelis to the table and obtain a compromise peace agreement that would give the Palestinian Authority sovereignty as a Palestinian state, is what they seek.
What could Russia add to this conversation, this negotiation?
Well, the Russians are increasing their presence in the Middle East. They have made a major commitment to support Assad in Syria, have troops and airplanes in Syria. They are changing for the better their relationship with Turkey, and they have aspirations to play a larger role throughout the Middle East. And if they could rise to the status of a broker and an internationally accepted arbiter, or at least the convener of a peace process, that would be good for them in the broader Middle East, because while this is no longer the central and, if you will, only issue around the Arab world, it remains a concern of Arabs kind of throughout the Middle East. And the Russians would like to raise their own profile and raise their own importance for their own reasons. And this gives them an opportunity by appearing to take us out of the picture.
So if the Palestinians feel they can't trust the United States as a moderator, as a fair go-between anymore, what happens next?
Well, it's probably the most important question. As I mentioned earlier, there hasn't been a lot of action. Everyone in the region has been waiting for the Trump administration to lay out its perspective on what kind of a peace agreement it sees. There is the president has made some comments that suggest that he is interested in looking at more than just a two-state solution. He said, I think, that he would accept any deal that all the parties could accept, and that a two-state was only one of the possibilities. So from that standpoint, there is still a focus on Washington and what Washington will do and what it will say. But this particular decision seems to suggest that the administration is more sympathetic to core Israeli aspirations with respect to Jerusalem than previous administrations have been, and prejudices the region's response to whatever it is that the administration may put forward as a vision.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson offered a rare glimpse yesterday into progress on the Trump administration's proposal for solving the decades-old conflict in the Middle East. The peace plan is being developed by the White House in a closely held process. It's been on Secretary of State's agenda while traveling across the Middle East this week, and we are exploring the dimensions of where U.S. foreign policy is headed in the Middle East. Veteran diplomat Ambassador Charlie Reese stays with us. He's a vice president at RAND Corporation. And you can join in the conversation. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What are your questions for the ambassador about how the Mideast peace process has evolved? Can peace be achieved? What do you think of the Trump administration's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll return to the conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. On December 6th, President Trump formally recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital. He delivered the speech from the White House.
While previous presidents have made this a major campaign promise, they failed to deliver. Today, I am delivering. I've judged this course of action to be in the best interests of the United States of America and the pursuit of peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
We're examining this foreign policy move and other developments in the Middle East. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Veteran U.S. diplomat Charlie Reese is with us. He's a vice president at the RAND Corporation, and he spent several decades in the U.S. diplomatic service. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. How do you think the new U.S. stance on Israel could affect peace negotiations between Israel and Palestine? How do you think all of this could affect the U.S. relationship with Middle Eastern countries? What questions do you have for the ambassador? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ambassador, let's talk a little bit about these settlements, the Palestinian settlements. We had Matt from Wausau who sent in an email. Can you explain the loss of Palestinian lands over the last century, as well as what are the living conditions like in Palestinian-held territory juxtaposed against that in the Israeli territory? Matt also adds, this rises to the level of ethnic cleansing, nothing more. Can you respond?
Well, first on the settlements, there are a lot of settlements now in the West Bank. There were also settlements in Gaza, but with the in 2006 when the Israelis withdrew from Gaza, they brought all the settlers, there are maybe 50,000 settlers in Gaza, home and subsidized their return. In the West Bank, there are two kinds of settlements. There are so-called settlement blocks, which are close on the eastern side of Jerusalem and along the border between the West Bank and the and Israel, with the so-called Green Line. And the vast majority of the 600,000 or so settlers are in those settlement blocks. And then there are something called settlement outposts. And these are smaller settlements that have been built to the east and in high points throughout the parts of the West Bank that were tended to be unpopulated. And in Oslo, there was actually a breakdown of the of three areas of the West Bank, so-called Area A, where the Palestinians would administer local responsibilities, Area B, where there's shared administration, and then Area C, which the Israelis would administer pending a final settlement. And most of the West Bank is in Area C, and most of the settlements are in Area C or Area B. And there is a complicated process that the Israelis go through to decide whether to authorize a new settlement. And that has been a matter that the United States has tried to influence over the years. We've tried to have them halt new settlement building, and we've had them pause it. And then there's been situations of illegal settlements. Those are settlements without any Israeli Defense Ministry approval. And in some cases, the Israelis have actually closed those down and sent the people who tried to create a hilltop illegal settlement home. But there is, as the caller suggests, quite a big difference between the standard of living and income levels of settlers versus the Palestinians who are living and in those areas. But that's true. There is a big difference between Israelis, the standard of living for Israelis, and that of Palestinians. And in many cases, the settlers tend to have lower income lower incomes than Israelis resident inside the Green Line in Israel. And in fact, in Israel, the price of housing is quite high. And when we were looking at this for the study we did 2 years ago called The Cost of Conflict, many experts believe that there are actually two groups of settlers. There is a group of settlers that are settlers because they have a vision of Judea and Samaria, the idea of greater Israel, that the West Bank should be Israeli or under the control and sovereignty of the Jewish state. And then there are a bunch, a very substantial portion of the settlers, of the 600,000, I'm no one's sure about what percentage, but a substantial percentage, that are basically looking for cheaper housing. Mm-hmm. Because the Israeli government for authorized settlements actually provides a variety of subsidies that make the cost of an apartment, the cost of maintenance of an apartment, the cost of water and electricity lower than it is in the main part of Israel within the Green Line. And so some are suburbanites, if you will, looking for cheaper housing. Like every American urban center, there are exurbs where people are willing to commute an hour so as to be able to afford a house. And some of the Israelis living in settlements are motivated by that.
Well, let's pause here for a moment on the issue of the economy and economics, because this is really the core of things that you have studied and worked with and looked at. When we see rising conflict and peace negotiations breaking down, when we see more tensions building up and conflict and fighting, do you see the border closing between West Bank and Gaza Strip? And what does that do to people trying to get back and forth between work, trying to get their food and staying on with their lives?
Well, there's no doubt that the situation of the residents of Gaza is very grim, and largely because the border is closed. Because the border is closed, it's very hard for them to find a way of making a living. Can't, you know, grow flowers or small manufacturers and so forth, because you can't sell them into Israel, and you can't export your goods to the world market across Israel, because the Israelis are taking, they take border closures as one of their main instruments to contain terrorism and rockets sent from Gaza. And Gaza is a very specific situation, it's very difficult. For the West Bank, there have been, since the early 2000s, when there was quite a bit of terrorism and violence that stemmed from youth in the West, in the West Bank crossing into Israel proper, the Israelis built a very large wall and dramatically constrained the freedom to travel into Israel for Palestinians. And
like a border wall.
Like a border wall, and this has affected the Palestinian economy in two ways. One, from a goods standpoint, it's harder for them to import and export goods to Israel. Although most of the products that you see in a supermarket in Ramallah or in the Palestinian areas are Israeli products. And it also makes it harder for Palestinians who used to be day laborers in Israel, people, and there's still 50 or 60,000 Palestinians who go across the border every day to jobs in the in Israel proper, construction and, you know, landscaping and all kinds of jobs. That it's much harder for them to get permits to do that, and that affects the Palestinian economy. That aggravates the difficulties that they have.
Ambassador, we have some calls for you waiting here. Let's go to Jeff, who joins us in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. Just as quick preamble, I've traveled to the Middle East a number of times over the past 25 years with UN and NGOs and others, and I actually worked briefly in Ramallah with a Palestinian Center for Democracy and Governance headed by Riyad Malki, who was part of the talks in Madrid. And my last trip to the region was just a few months ago. What I find is that, as I'm sure the ambassador realized, the U.S. is just becoming more and more, how do I say this, inconsequential, if not irrelevant, to any process there, easily overlooked. And I'm wondering what the ambassador believes the next president, because there will be a next president. I know that sounds the far future at this point, but what should the next president do to start renewing or repairing or, you know, pick your verb, revising the relationship? What two or three things could the next president do to get the U.S. back as a meaningful player, if not the broker in the process?
Jeff, thanks for the contribution. Go ahead, Ambassador Reese.
Well, Jeff, I guess the professional in me would say that the next administration, the next president will have to deal with the situation as they find it when they take office. And so the first thing that the new administration should do is kind of assess the circumstances and then maximize the use of American leverage for American interests. And it sounds like a truism, but what I'm trying to say is that the choices that the next president will have will depend on what happens in the next couple of years. So it's a little bit hard to say what might happen, what the choices should be. But it has been the case that every new president coming into office, and President Trump is no exception, has looked at this ever since Eisenhower, has looked at this from the standpoint of what can I do to reduce the risks to American security interests and American moral standing by trying to devise a permanent arrangement. And we've been through lots of different mechanisms. For a while, there was a UN-led body called the Quartet, but it devolved into everyone looking to see the Americans. The Europeans, it devolved into everyone looking to see what did the Americans think we ought to do. So it was still pretty much a US-led process, even though the EU and Russians were involved. I think that you're right. In the present circumstances, we have lost. Sorry, I have a little bit of a cold. We have lost honest broker status that we had and had obtained through many years of trying to work to find a fair deal.
So how does that play out if we have lost honest broker status?
Well, let's put it this way. Maybe lost is the wrong verb. We don't have it now because of the circumstances of this particular decision and the rhetoric that has been used in general and the way that the administration has approached Middle East diplomacy. But that isn't to say that in the future, in a different set of circumstances, the United States is still a large and powerful country. We have a lot of instruments that would be important to making a negotiated agreement work. And so we'll still be involved in the solution. Whether we would be the sole leader or not, it's hard to tell.
Veteran diplomat and RAND Corporation Vice President Charlie Reese is with us for this conversation on the peace process in the Middle East and where the United States fits into this. You can add to this discussion at 800-642-1234. Have you been to Israel or Palestine? Do you have family or friends who live there? What are your impressions when you travel to the Holy City? Join in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ambassador, so let us take a moment here and look at implications around the Middle East. We had in Saudi Arabia, King Salman told President Trump, quote, moving the U.S. embassy is a dangerous step that provokes the feelings of Muslims around the world. King Abdullah of Jordan, where also condemned the decision. According to a statement there, the king feels that, quote, the adoption of this resolution will have serious implications for security and stability in the Middle East. So when we are seeing these kinds of impressions coming out from the broader Middle East, what are your insights there?
Well, I think Arab world, as you know, the statements from King Abdullah, King Salman, also the General Sisi in Egypt, have all been opposed to the idea of the United States Embassy moving because, as I mentioned earlier, it presupposes a judgment on the sovereignty and takes that issue off. Jerusalem is also a very emotive issue for Muslims everywhere because of the Dome of the Rock, the third most revered mosque in the world for Muslims, and the implication that full Israeli sovereignty and control over these sites would make it harder for pilgrims to visit the Dome of the Rock and so forth. And that those are important issues for Saudis and for Egyptians and for Jordanians. And so it's important for leaders of those countries to maintain their own credibility with their own people, that they stand up and speak when something like this appears to be a negative. One thing that it is interesting is that this decision itself hasn't led to widespread demonstrations and violence throughout the Middle East, which it might have 10 years ago.
We don't see intifada.
Haven't seen an intifada-like actions either in Palestinian areas or in the broader Middle East. And that's probably because of the outcome of the Arab Spring and many other changes that have happened in the broader Arab world and the challenges that Arab leaders and societies have more broadly. For King Salman, they're very concerned about the Iranians and the Iranian challenge to their interests in the Gulf, the creation of Syria that seems less connected to the Gulf leadership and the sort of Sunni Arab world and more a satellite state of either Russia or Iran or both together. So those are big issues for these leaders. And while there's no doubt of their views on Jerusalem, they have to balance objectives, their own national objectives, just like any other country. And that's, I think, a reason why it's been of limited explosive capacity.
Let's bring in Saeed, who joins us from Green Bay.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. And you hit to pretty much the question I was going to ask, which is as a result of the of the nuclear deal signed with Iran, the containment of Iran has been lost, and now the strategic alignment in the Middle East is very different than in the past. Now, moderate Arab states and Israel find themselves strategically aligned because the Palestinian issue is, I think, subordinated to the very significant existential threat that Iran poses to both moderate Arab states and Israel. Contrary to what the previous caller said about the United States being irrelevant, I think the United States plays a very pivotal role now in being a balancing force to Russia, Syria, Iran, and Hezbollah in Lebanon. The moderate Arab states look to the United States to provide that counterbalance. And my question is, why can this not be exploited to put the Palestinian issue to some final rest?
Saeed, thanks for the call. The observations, Ambassador Reese.
Well, I think you're right, Saeed, that there is this larger existential crisis, and it is a crisis which has seen the moderate Arab states and Israel and the United States on the same side. That is to say, a side of sharp concern over what it would mean for the peace and security of the region if the Iranians were to develop and deploy a nuclear capability, that is, in a sense, a much more serious threat.
And I think that the administration, the Trump administration's effort to find a larger deal is based on that that observation. In the very large sort of history of Middle East peace process, there's an idea that there's a so-called outside-in approach or an inside-out approach. And the outside-in approach is you basically get the Saudis and the Jordanians and other major players to encourage the Palestinians to make a deal and agree to support that deal politically and economically. And then the United States and Western countries encourage the Israelis to accept that deal and agree to support the deal economically and politically. And so that's the vision, that's how we that's a very valid way to conceptualize the problem. The Jerusalem decision itself, which we started out by talking about, is doesn't, I think, help that outside-in deal because it makes it somewhat more difficult for the Saudis, for example, to normalize their relationships with the Israelis, which were otherwise on a very positive path because of their combined or their joint concern about Iran and the Iranian nuclear threat. So it's a brick in a larger mosaic or a larger wall of construction, and you put the brick in, and it makes the design a little bit more complicated.
We're working through the design, the political dynamics, if you will, in the peace process that aims to stop ongoing clashes. Palestinians are seeking to replace the U.S. as a peace broker, we learned recently, and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas plans to address the UN Security Council on Tuesday. Veteran diplomat and RAND Corporation Vice President Charlie Reese is our guide for this conversation. You can add your question, comments to the discussion on the Middle East at 800-642-1234. Do you have family or friends there? What are your impressions when you travel to Jerusalem? Join in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll return to the discussion in a brief moment. Vice President Mike Pence addressed the Israeli parliament last month. He received enthusiastic applause before he delivered his speech.
Jerusalem is Israel's capital. And as such, President Trump has directed the State Department to immediately begin preparations to move the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
The vice president said the administration's plan to move the embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem would happen by the end of 2019. It's a faster timeline than the one that was previously reported. We're exploring the Mideast peace process this hour, gathering your thoughts along the way. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. Ambassador Charlie Reese is our guide. He's vice president of international at RAND Corporation. Your thoughts are welcome at 800-642-1234. Is peace in the Middle East possible? What will it take? Why should Americans care about this issue? Bring your perspective at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Steve now, who joins us from River Falls, Minnesota. Hi, Steve. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thank you for having us, letting us call in and doing this program. I had the great privilege a year ago of visiting Jerusalem and the West Bank with my family and visiting a family friend who spent the year there. And so we had the opportunity to see firsthand what life is like there. And I think that, like so many issues, we get the headlines, but the reality of conflicts like this often boil down to economic ones and issues of daily life. And the story I think that is rarely told and that most Americans can't appreciate is just how difficult day-to-day life is for Palestinians because they have so little control, because the government of Israel puts so many constraints on them. And some examples, your guest talked about the wall, which you call the border wall, and the impression when you see it is it's a wall like the previous Berlin Wall. It's a huge concrete barrier full of checkpoints with armed guards, and many, many Palestinians, if not the majority, are never allowed to cross into Jerusalem through that border crossing. That's one issue. Many Palestinians have jobs, live in the West Bank, but have jobs in Jerusalem. Your guests referred to that. But what doesn't get told is that those people never know from one day to the next how long it's going to take them to get from work to work. With no traffic and a easy crossing, it might be a 30-minute drive. And it's very frequently, for no obvious reason, that those checkpoints are closed, and their commute can change from 30 minutes to 2 or 3 hours. And that was a story that was told commonly over and over again by people. Our host made a trip to a bordering town in the West Bank from her West Bank city, did not have to cross into Israel, and yet on the return trip, again, for no reason apparent, the highway that she was trying to get back to her home on was closed down. Israeli military vehicles pulled in, closed it down, and just for 2 hours. And this is
Steve. And Steve, thank you so much for the comments. Ambassador Reese, I think we get the gist of what Steve is saying.
Right.
Your reaction to these observations?
Well, we did a study. I was a co-lead of a RAND study in 2015 called The Costs of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. And we attempted to quantify all those costs and also what the benefits would be of a two-state solution or some other solution that would be a difference from the status quo. And interestingly, you're right, and I had mentioned earlier some of the constraints on the Palestinian economy of the present circumstances. And the Palestinians would gain very substantially from a peace agreement. We estimated that in 10 years their economy would be 46% bigger than it would be, which would be a substantial $2,000 for every per capita for every Palestinian. But it also brought out the fact that the Israeli economy would be better off in a two-state solution. We calculated 5%, but because the Israeli economy is larger, much larger, and the per capita income is much bigger, that the actual dollar value of peace would be higher for Israel than it would be for the Palestinian areas. The Israelis gain not only from the reduction of these transport barriers, but they also would gain from regularization of their trade and a big prospects of increased trade to the rest of the Arab world if this were off the agenda. So there are big economic stakes for both sides.
Steve, thanks. Let's go to Donna, who's been patient with us in Oshkosh. Hi, Donna.
Hello, and thank you so much for taking my thoughts. And Ambassador, thank you so much for listening to us. I am against the movement to the capital, to Jerusalem. And the elephant that is in the room, it seems to me, is that Zionists are only a part of the Jewish entity. And they are very, very arrogant, which I have seen through the years. I'm old enough to remember when that state was initiated. And while the Palestinians have had to give up increasingly their land, just as we took away the Indians' land here, they fight with stones and they are countered with machine guns.
Donna, what about the relationship, though, with Benjamin Netanyahu and Jared Kushner? I know you wanted to bring up that relationship.
Yes, both of these men are facing corrupt charges. And there's no way we can get to any peace agreement while these people are the players. The United States should step back respectfully, step back, and let the people who have not got all these interests going come forward with some very good, solid things so the Palestinians have some dignity in their own land and it's returned to a place that they can all survive well.
Donna, thanks. Ambassador Reese.
Well, it's hard to comment specifically on her point of view. I would just say that what we as diplomats try to do is try to make the best, get the best outcomes for the country, given the political leadership that is chosen democratically in those countries. And Prime Minister Netanyahu is presently Prime Minister of Israel. And if we're going to deal with Israel, we have to deal with him and the government, and that's what professionals do.
Let's go to Joe in somewhere in Wisconsin. Joe, go ahead.
Hi there. I'm just curious as to why it's not discussed more often openly. That's pretty much every single one of our allies. In fact, almost every single country in the world considers all of the settlements, including those in East Jerusalem, to be a type of war crime based on the fact that the Geneva Convention says that you cannot have civilians occupying or moving into areas that are militarily occupied, which they all are and have been for 50 years. We, back in the 1970s when Carter was president, the only legal determination the United States ever made about the status of that is that it's a war crime.
Yeah, and let's get Ambassador Reese to weigh in there. And he's reaching back to the Carter administration there.
Right. Well, I would say that the United States has not accepted, and even this administration has not accepted, the sovereignty of Israel over the West Bank and the status of the settlements, like the status of Jerusalem, is a final status issue to be solved by negotiation. When President Clinton was trying to work out a two-state solution, he laid out something called the Clinton parameters in 2000, and the Clinton parameters envisaged that the settlement blocks, those are the densely populated areas and settlements right on the border, would be swapped into Israel for other land that the Palestinians would get that is presently Israeli sovereign land. And so there would be border adjustments in such a way to make a two-state solution work and to essentially be even with the 67 armistice line. And that's the many professionals and many people from all over the world have thought that in the two-state solution or in the final resolution that there would be an adjustment. But until such time, the settlements are just what they are, which is in very precarious international legal status. And indeed, many countries, all the European Union and the Russians and the Chinese and other important countries all over the world have condemned the settlement expansion and believed that this was an obstacle to peace.
Ambassador Reese, thank you so much for making time for us.
My pleasure.
State Department veteran diplomat Charlie Reese is a vice president international at the RAND Corporation. His research focusing on the economics of international development spent several decades in the State Department, previously serving as an ambassador and U.S. Foreign Service officer in the Middle East and Europe, including coordinator for economic transition in Iraq. Star of the Morning Show was produced by Colleen Leahy and Nyasia Ellison. Dean Kinetter provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.